This topic, Chaucer's contribution to English language and literature. Introduction. Father of verse, who in immortal song first taught the muses to speak the English tongue. It is somewhat ideal to talk the fathers in the history of literature, for it is questionable if a particular person can be wholly credited with the founding of a new literary genre. Literature is generally subject to the law of evolutionary development, and though a man may do more than other by way of contributing to this development, we should be chary of conferring upon him the medal of fatherhood. When it is said that Chaucer is the father of English poetry and even the father of English literature, we broadly means that his contribution to the evolution of English poetry or literature is much more significant than that of these contemporaries of predecessors, and to be similarly rated is his introduction to so many novels features into it. That Chaucer was pioneer in many respects should be readily granted. With him is born our real poetry. Says Matthew Arnold, he has been acclaimed as the first realist, the first humorist, and the first narrative artist, the first great character painter, and the first great metrical artist in English literature. Further, he has been credited not only with the fatherhood of English poetry, but has also been held as the father of English drama before the drama was born, and the father of English novel before the novel was born. And what is more, his importance is not due to precedence alone, but due to excellence. He is not only the first English poet, but a great poet in his own right. Justly has he been called the fountain source of vast esteem in English literature. Contribution to language. Well, does Lowell says the Chaucer found his English a dialect and left it a language. Borrowing Saintsbury words about the transformation which Dryden affected in English poetry, we may justly say that Chaucer found the English language brick and left it marble. When Chaucer started his literary career, the English speech and still less the English of writing was confusingly fluid and unsettled. The English language was divided into number of dialects which were employed in different parts of country. The four of them vastly more prominent than the other were. The first Southern, second Midland, third Northern and Northumbrian, and the fourth is Kentish. Out of these four, the Midland or the East Midland dialect, which was spoken in London and its surrounding area, was the simplest in grammar and syntax. Moreover, it was the one patronized by the aristocratic and literary circle of the country. Zoar used the dialect for his poem Confessio Amantis and Wycliffe for his translation of the Bible, but this dialect was not the vehicle of all literary work. Other dialect had their votaries too. Longland in his Peer Plowman, to quote the instance, used a mixture of Southern and Midland dialects. Chaucer employed in his work the East Midland dialects, and by casting the enormous weight of his genius in the imbalance, decided once for all which dialect was going to be the standard literary language of the whole of the country for all times to come. None after him thought of using any dialect other than the East Midland for any literary work of consequence. It is certain that if Chaucer had adopted some other dialect of emergence of the standard language of literature, would have been considerably delayed. All the great writers of England succeeding Chaucer are, in the word of John Spears, master of the language, of which Chaucer is before them the great master. Not only was Chaucer's selection of one dialect out of the four a happy one, but So was his selection of one of the three languages which were reigning supreme in England at the time, Latin, French and English. In fact, Latin and the French were more fashionable than the poor vernacular English. Latin was considered the universal language and was patronized at the expense of English by the church as well as the learned. Before Wycliffe translated it into the vulgar tongue, the Bible was read in its Latin version called the Vulgate. French was the language of the court and was used to keeping the accounts of the royal household till as late as 1365. Perplexed by the variety of language offering themselves for use, Chaucer's friend and contemporary Zouvre could not decide which one of them to adopt. He wrote his Miroir del Homme in French, Ox Clementis in Latin, and Confessio Amantis in English. Perhaps because he was not quite sure which of the three languages was going to survive. But Chaucer had few doubts about the issue. He chose English, which was a despised language, and as the legendary king did, the beggar mad, raised her from the dust, draped her in royal robes, and conduct her coronation that queen is ruling even now. Contribution to verification. Chaucer's contribution to English versification is no less striking than to the English language. Again, it is an instance of a happy choice. The sounded the death knell of the old Saxon alterative measure and firmly established the modern one. Even in the 14th century, the old alliterative measure had been employed by such a considerable poet as Longland for this Pierce and Plowman, and the writer of Sir Jean and the Green Knights. Let us give the important feature of the old measure which Chaucer so categorically disowned. The first, there is no regularity in the number of syllables in each line. One line may have as few as 6 syllables and another as many as 14. Second, the use of alliteration as the chief ornamental device and as the lone structural principle, all the alliterative syllables are stressed. Third, absence of end rhyme. And fourth, frequent reception of express vacance and intensity of emotion. Chaucer had no patience with the rum, ram, rough of the alterative measures, so does the maintain in the person's tales. But trusteth well, I am southern man, I cannot guess from ram, rough, fiery letter. Nay, good word rhyme hold I but little better of that old-fashioned measure, but he substitute the regular line with end rhyme, which he borrowed from France. The new measure has the following characteristics. First, all lines have the same number of syllables. Second, end rhyme. Third, absence of alliteration and frequent reception. After Chaucer, no important poet ever thought of reverting to the old measure. Thus, Chaucer may be designated the father of modern English versification. Chaucer employed three principal meter in his work. The Centenary Tales, he mostly used line of 10 syllable each in bracket with generally 5 accents bracket close, and the line run into the couplet. That is, each couple of line has its end syllable rhyming with each other. For example, his eye twinkled in his head right as dawn stars in the frosty night. In Troilus and Cressyed, Cressyde, he used the 7-line stanza of decasyllabic lines with 5 accent, each having rhyme scheme A B A B C C. His measure was borrowed by him from the French and is called the Rhyme Royal of Chaucerian Stanza. The third principal meter employed by him is octosyllabic couplet with four accent and end rhyme. In the book of the Duchess, his measure is used. The measures thus adopted by Chaucer were seized upon by his successor. The decasyllabic couplet, known as the heroic couplet, was to be chiseled and invigorated the perfection the three centuries later by Dryden and Poe. Apart from those three principal measures, Chaucer also employed for the first time a number of their stanzaic forms in his shorter poems. Not only his, Chaucer seems to be first Englishman who realized and brought out of latent music of his language. To read Chaucer's verse, observes a critic, is like listening to a clear stream in a meadow full of sunshine, replying over its bed and pebbles the following its tribute of a worthy successor of his. The morning star of song who made his music heard below, Don Chaucer, the first warbler whose sweet breath prelude those melodious breasts that feel the spacious times, the great Elizabeth, with sound that echoes still. He made English a pliant and vigorous medium of poetic utterance. His astonishingly easy mastery of the language is indeed remarkable. With one step of writing, Chaucer carries us into a new era in which the language appears endowed with grace, dignity, and copiousness of expression, and clothed in the hue of imagination. The content of poetry. Chaucer was a pioneer not only in the linguistic and prosodic field, but was one of the strictly poetic field also. Not only the form of poetry, but its content too is highly indebted to him. Not only did he give English poetry a new dress, but a new body and new soul. His major contribution toward the content of poetry is in his advocacy of an strict adherence to realism. His Shrewsbury Tales embodies a new effort in the history of literature, as it strictly deals with real men, manner, and life. In the beginning of his literary career, Chaucer followed his contemporaries and immediate predecessors and wrote allegorical and dream poetry, which in its content was as remote from life as a dream is from reality. But at the age of about 50, he realized that the literature should deal firsthand with life and not look at it through the spectacle of book or a hazy hues of dreams and cumbers allergy. Literature should deal firsthand with the life and not look at it through the spectacle of book or the hazy hues of dreams and the cumbersome allergy. He realized to adopt Pope's famous couplet in bracket with a little change. Know then thyself, presume not dreams to scan, the proper study of mankind is man. And the product of this realization was the Shrewsbury Tales. This poem, as it were, hold a mirror to the life of Chaucer is and shows its manner and moral completely, not in fragment. Chaucer replaced effectively the shadowy delineation of the old romantic and allegorical school with the vivid and pulsating picture of contemporary life. And Chaucer does not forget the universal beneath, the particular and deathless beneath and death. The portrait of pilgrims in the prologue of Shrewsbury Tales constitute not only an epitome of the society of 14th century England, but the epitome of human nature in all climes and all ages. Grierson and Smith observe about Chaucer's pilgrim, in inverted comma, they are all with us today, though some of them have changed their names. The knight Now command a line regiment. The square is in God. The shipman was a rum runner. While prohibition lasted and is attractive now to black market, the friar is a jolly supporting publican. And pardoner went cook medicines or hold science. And prioress is the headmistress of a fashionable girls' school. Some of them have reappeared in a later literature. The poor person was reincarnated with the vicar of Wakefield at the knight in Colonel Newcomb and the monk in Archdeacon Grantly. Inverted comma closed. His geniality, tolerance, humor, and freshness. Chaucer's tone as a poet is wonderfully instinct with geniality, tolerance, humor, and freshness, which are absent from that of his contemporaries and predecessors, who are too dreamy, too serious, and to be interesting, in spite of his awareness of corruption and unrest in society of his age. Chaucer is never upset or upsetting. He experiences what the French call joie de vivre, joie de vivre, and communicate it to his readers. No one can read Chaucer without feeling that it is good to be alive in this world, however imperfect may it be in numerous respects. He is a chronic optimist. He is never harsh, rancorous, bitter, or indignant, and never falls out with his fellow men for their falling. He lives didacticism and longland and moral jover, and himself peacefully coexist with all human imperfection. It does not mean that he is not sarcastic and satirical, but his satire and sarcasms are always seasoned with lovely humor. In fact, his forte is irony rather than satire. Aldous Huxley observed in inverted comma, where Longland cries aloud in anger, threatening the world with hellfire, Chaucer looks on the smiles. Inverted comma closed. The great English humorists like Shakespeare and Fielding share with Chaucer the same broad human sympathy with he first introduced into literature and which he bestowed upon the Sainsbury Tales, that characters and perennials vernal freshness which appears to abundantly on its every page. Contribution to the novel. The novel is one of the latest course in the banquet of English literature, but in his narrative skill, his gift of the wide characterization, his aptitude for plot construction, and his inventive skill, Chaucer appears as a worthy precursor of the race of novelists who comes centuries afterwards. If Chaucer is the father of English poetry, he is certainly the use G.K. Chesterton phrase, the grandfather of the English novel. His tales are replete with intense human interest, and though the borrows his material from numerous sundry sources, his narrative skill is all his own that could not have been borrowed. His narration is lively and direct. If we make exception for the numerous digression and philosophical and pseudo-philosophical animadversion having little to do with the tale proper introduced after the contemporary fashion, it is difficult to find him flagging or growing dull and monotonous. It is perhaps only Burns who is Tom O'Center Excel Chaucer in the telling of Merry Tales. Chaucer's prologue to Sainsbury Tales has been rightly called the prologue of modern fiction. It has characters, if not plot, and wide characterization is one of the primary jobs of a novelist. A novel, according to Meredith, should be a summary of actual life. So is indeed the prologue. Several of the tales to our novel in the miniature and hold the attention of the reader from a beginning to the end, which alas, very few novels of today do. As regards Chaucer's Troilus and Cressyde, Cressyde, it has been well called a novel in verse, and it has all the salient feature of a novel. It has plot, character, unraveling, action, conflict, rising action, and denouncement, everything. Though the background of the action is the legendary Trojan War, though some elements have been borrowed from the Italian writer Boccaccio, and it is all very modern and close to life, it is not devoid even the psychological interest which is a major characteristic of the modern novel. Its heroine, as a critic observed, is the subtlest piece of psychological analysis in medieval fiction. In the suit and particle Pandrus, in the character whose presence of itself brings the story down from heights of romance to the plane of real life. S.D. Nell opines that had Chaucer written in prose, it is possible that it Troilus and Cressyde and not Richardson's Pamela would have been celebrated as the first English novel. A.W. Pollard facetiously observed that Chaucer was a compound of 30% of Goldsmith, 50 of Wilding, and 20 of Walter Scott. This means, in other words, that as a storyteller, Chaucer had some of the sweetness of Goldsmith, his genial ironic attitude and realism of Fielding, and the high chivalrous tone of Sir Walter Scott. But after all is said and done, Chaucer is Chaucer himself and himself alone. Contribution to the drama. Chaucer wrote a time when, like the novel, secular drama had not been born, and at his work have been dramatic elements which are altogether missing in the poetry before him. His mode of characterization in the prologue of Canterbury Tales is no doubt static or descriptive, but in the tales proper it is dynamic for dramatic. There the character reveals themselves without the intervention of the author through what they say and what they do. Even the tales they narrate, in most cases, are in keeping with their respective characters. Narrators, in most cases, are the keeping an evocation, temperament, etc. In this way, Chaucer is clearly ahead of his model Boccaccio, who in his Decameron allots various tales to his ladies and gentlemen indiscriminately, irrespectively of their conformity of otherwise of their respective characters. The stories in the Decameron could without violence be redistributed among their characters, but not the Canterbury Tales, where they serve as a dramatic device of characterization. And in the drama, Pace, Aristotle character is all important in their disputation and destruction. The comment upon each other's tales and their general behavior to the pilgrim are made by Chaucer to reveal themselves and to provide finishing touch of the character portrayed already statically in bracket or non-dramatically bracket close set forth in the prologue. Chaucer is abundantly showing her the essential gift of the dramatist. A critic goes so far as to assert that Chaucer is, in inverted comma, a dramatist in all but the fact. And again, if the drama had been known in Chaucer's time as a branch of living literature, he might have attained as high excellence in comedy as an English or conventional writer. Chaucer's limitations. Let us round off our discussion by briefly referring to some of Chaucer's limitations or what was. The father of English poetry, he could not give to it. Matthew Arnold feels in Chaucer's work the absence of high seriousness, which is characteristic of all great poetry. Then Chaucer has, unlike Dante, no burning message to give. Again, as Hudson ever, he is not the poet of the people. Moody and Lovett maintain that Chaucer wrote for court and cultivated classes to whom the suffering of the poor were a matter of the utmost indifference. Still another critic find missing from Chaucer's poetry those mysterious significance which are characteristic of all great poetry. All this is in measures due, but those who charge Chaucer with the absence of pathos may well read the following passage from The Night Stills, in which Arcite lament his separation consequent upon his death from his lady love. Alas the woe, alas the pain strong that I for you have suffered and so long. Alas the death, alas mine Emily, alas departing of for company. Alas mine heartless queen, alas my wife. Mine heartless lady, ender of my life, what is this word? What asken men to have? Now with his love, now in his cold grave, alone, without any company. Farewell, my sweet, farewell, my Emily, and softly take me in your arms to a, for love of God and heaven's what I say.